We begin with Mary Oliver. You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about your despair, yours, and I will tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clear blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over announcing your place in the family of things. Your place in the family of things. This is our struggle, finding our place as individuals, as communities, finding our place and the meaning of it all. We are such a curious lot, we Unitarian Universalists. A mentor of mine used to remark that we are, after all, the land of misfit toys. I always wondered about that. We are too independently minded to be defined by creed or unifying dogma, but also we crave, as human beings do, the connections, the wholeness that we might find in community. And we are seekers of truth, of justice, but mostly seekers, whether we are conscious of it or not, of the capacity that allows us to freely love what it loves, to let the soft animal of our bodies love what they love. It is no small task. The soft animal of our bodies is a vulnerable place, an open and exposed and risk-laden place that we might get to experience every now and again, but usually only with those most trusted. Otherwise, we protect ourselves out of fear or experience. Like a night-blooming cereus, have you seen them ever? The exquisite blossom that shows itself only in the safety of darkness and closes with the dawn. We humans retreat from the exposing light of day and cover the soft spaces, and in our defensiveness, in our protection and our isolation, we make mistakes and we offend. How can we not? We have closed ourselves to love. Consider the postures of the father and the brother in our parable this morning. It is from the Gospel of Luke. The prodigal son returns, and the father's arms are open wide, exposing the soft animal of his body, loving what it loves. We know nothing else about this human than that. And the brother is closed, self-protected, safe from hurt and alone. We can imagine holding the piece of hot coal in his scarred hand. So years ago, somewhere in the midst of the late 19th and early 20th centuries, our tradition as partners in the primarily Western liberal religious movement effected a cultural transformation. We're moving now from personal imagery to the bigger picture. Somewhere in the midst of the time of the Enlightenment, liberal religion rejected the theological construct of original sin. I want to share an example of how that rejection influenced our fellow religionists in perhaps more conservative environments. When I was growing up in the Episcopal Church, we shared together every Sunday a general confession. The Catholic Church, we know, does a more personal confession, and in the Episcopal Church, when all gather, a prayer is said together, Almighty and most merciful Father, we have erred and strayed from thy ways like lost sheep. We have followed too much the devices and desires of our own hearts. We have left undone those things which we ought to have done, and done those things which we ought not to have done. And there is no health in us. That was the line. There was no health in us. It was Augustine who bequeathed that concept to Christianity in the late 4th and 5th centuries. The idea that we were all born with the depravity of Adam and Eve's fall, and that Jesus took on that burden in order to absolve us all. The gift of our liberal inclinations in the Enlightenment to the more traditional and dogmatic environments like the Episcopal Church is that that line, there is no health in us, is no longer a part of the general confession. What an interesting gift to our more conservative family. This is a gift of liberalism to the conservative church, a good gift. Now one confesses their shortcomings without the burden of original and unearned illness. But as theologian James Luther Adams, who was a Unitarian Universalist minister, reminds us, not all the fruits issuing from the new movement were actually intended or expected by its proponents. Religious liberalism, in the name of intellectual integrity, tended to neglect the deeper levels both of the human consciousness and of reality itself. So these are abstract threads we're pulling together here, right? And what we realize is that now, as a result of our liberal leanings and our moving away from the more conservative constructs of original sin and judgment, we do not, in this church, in most Unitarian Universalist congregations, confess anything to anyone as a regular part of our collective practice or liturgy, even necessarily as a form to ourselves. We have eschewed words like sin. We have appealed to our capacity for reason, often in lieu of emotion, those deeper levels of the human consciousness that Adams refers to. In our efforts to avoid the problematic trappings of religious construct, heavily loaded rituals and creedal professions, we have narrowed the range of acceptable imaginative expression, or we have so broadened it that it has few particulars. And there has been a cost to that. It feels that we have folded our arms in, protecting the soft animals of our bodies from exposure, even as we have shaken loose ourselves from those theological judgments. The question becomes, what have we lost in our freedom? And I wonder if it is too often the engagement of our hearts with our frailties, our tender and vulnerable broken places. If we do not acknowledge our mistakes as a discipline, how are we forgiven? And how do we practice forgiving ourselves or each other? How does the heart mend, our own hearts or someone else's? It is not shameful to be imperfect. It is human. A former colleague of mine had a picture on his wall of a teacup, pristine, beautiful, and whole. I know this cup is already broken, it read, and so I love it immensely. It is the nature of our human experience and our human existence to be broken already, to varying degrees, disconnected. The only problem is when we try to pretend we're not, when we, like the brother, close our arms to protect our hearts, leaving only our heads to explain away our foibles or to think through our disconnections, when we relegate to the mind what the heart feels. The head rationalizes, the heart experiences. I was reading a sermon called Faith's Vital Balance by the Reverend Harry Haler, who was minister at the Weston Unitarian Universalist Congregation years ago. That congregation was so helpful to Theodore Parker in the early 80s by way of providing ministry and funding and volunteer assistance. Harry's sermon is in a book that was published, and he opens the first one with a reading from Williams College professor James Bissett Pratt. He asks us and invites us to consider the imagery. In a Buddhist temple such as this, Pratt wrote, one seems transported to another world. In such a setting, the chanting of Buddha's praises by the monks seems something eternally appropriate. Long before dawn, it begins, the last coming at the end of the evening. As the gongs join in chorus, the gray figure of a monk appears, crossing the lower court in the moonlight and climbing the broad marble staircase before the temple. Others silently follow one by one, swimming through the luminous darkness. One of them opens the temple doors, lights the candles on the altar and the incense sticks. The other monks steal in after him through the moonbeams and the shadows. They bow and prostrate themselves, and the chanting begins. Contrast this, Haler writes, with a Unitarian Universalist service that he attended in California. A plain meeting hall, no hymns or prayers or readings. The program consisted of a lively debate over recent denominational resolutions, and there were announcements, and then a discussion about how best to assist in a local justice project. A handshake closed the service. He was assured that during the fall and the winter and the spring months, soloists and poetry readings were worked into the service. We are somewhere in between these two extremes here, with more color and music than our California cousins, but little prostrate practice among us that I have observed. It's not that one is right and one is wrong, but or even preferable, but Haler's point is that each are incomplete without the other. Bowing to the mystery does not change the world as we know it. Neither does attending to service alone move our hearts to new levels of wonder or humility or compassion on its own. We are considering forgiveness this month as a pathway to wholeness that we Unitarian Universalists often neglect. Not a pathway to perfection, but to a repaired sense of being. When we recognize the places of our falling short and love ourselves anyway, when we see the hurt caused by another and love them anyway, our arms begin to unfold, to gradually expose the soft animals of our bodies, loving even in our brokenness, loving what we love immensely. Someone asked me once if I didn't believe that prayers need a recipient. Don't we need to pray to something or someone? No, I don't believe we do. One can, of course, but it's not a requirement. Prayers are for opening our hearts. The conversation is with the life force within ourself, the spirit that animates us, that gives us being in this particular time and place. Similarly, forgiveness. which comes as a humble function of the acceptance that we are lovable and we are made to be loved, arrives to us. Every tie of "I'm sorry" and "I forgive you" binds us closer to this truth. It is a release more than a petition, that forgiveness. I've been rereading a book by Marilynne Robinson called Gilead. I'm not sure if any of you have had that experience. It's a wonderful journey. It is the writing of an elder minister reviewing his life in the form of a letter to his young child. Much of it engages with forgiveness, which is why I was rereading it recently. The main character, John Ames, has a lifelong friend who is also a minister and nearing the end of his life, and not quite up to his former tricks. His name is Bolton. If Bolton could be himself, John Ames thinks, he would utterly pardon every transgression, past, present, and to come, whether or not it was a transgression, in fact, or his to pardon. He would be that extravagant. "That is a thing I would love to see," John Ames says. He would be that extravagant, like the father with arms stretched wide, maybe someone with a very short string of distance from the practice of apology and forgiveness. That extravagant. Where do you practice forgiveness in your life? How do you come to it? It is a question we need to ask ourselves more often. And with the question, the word grace comes to mind, mysterious and ethereal, with no earthly tether or imagery. Grace arrives, bidden or not, when we practice humility, awareness, apology. Grace lands on our hearts with love, forgiving us and reminding us of our potential for extravagant pardon, of our capacity to expose the soft animal of our bodies to love what we love and find our place in the family of things. It bears more practice, such that our prodigal natures, when lost, might be found.